content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 13, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in white lettering, superimposed upon a pale beige background. The photo featured on this cover is of a man. He has gray hair combed back from his face. He has brown eyes. In his left earlobe are three tiny gold loops. He's wearing black. He has, well, a maybe dark gray shirt, black tie, black striped, black and gray striped vest, a black leather jacket, and blue jeans. It is Bruce Springsteen. Turning to the brief first, Silencing the Critics by Brian Bennett. After Charlie Kirk's killing, President Trump looks for ways to clamp down on dissent. Again, this is by Brian Bennett. In his zeal to punish opponents, as in so much else, President Donald Trump has made no secret of being willing to defy norms. He crosses politics with justice. He's been open about having ordered the September 25 federal indictment of former FBI Director James Comey, despite reports that some administration officials found the evidence thin, and has sought to clamp down on speech and protest from his detractors. That dynamic was made explicit when Vice President J.D. Vance appeared on Charlie Kirk's podcast the Monday after the conservative activist was killed. "We are going to go after the NGO network that foments and facilitates and engages in violence," he said. And facilities is the word. It is not facilitates. He said, referring to non-governmental organizations he claimed are left-leaning. A study of U.S. political violence by the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute found that right-wing terrorism has caused more deaths than leftist violence, both over the past 5 years and since 1975. Asked about the administration's plans, a White House official told Time in a statement, "The White House is exploring a wide variety of options to put pen to paper to address left-wing political violence and the network of organizations that fuel and fund it." Such vows extend the administration's efforts to bring to heel its critics, including political opponents, universities, major media outlets, and now charities. Experts say one tactic that's been mentioned could be especially harmful to some of the targeted groups, going after their tax-exempt status. For many charities, losing that status, which allows donors to deduct donations, would be the end of the road, says Ofer Lyon, a lawyer based in Los Angeles, who's an expert on nonprofit tax law. Such a change would hobble a group's fundraising, as well as potentially force it to pay taxes on funds it holds in an endowment. But the White House's path to revoke a group's tax-exempt status would be difficult and could lead to protracted court battles. To gain tax-exempt status, an organization must submit paperwork to the Internal Revenue Service in which it explains its intention to further charitable educational, scientific, or religious purposes, the law already allows the IRS to suspend the tax-exempt status of a nonprofit that is supporting or engaging in terrorist activity. Typical IRS investigations focus on how funds are being used and whether an organization is operating for exempt purposes, says Roger Colenvo, professor of law at the Catholic University of America. Viewpoint should not come into it at all, Colenvo says. Many of the country's major philanthropies were alarmed by Vance's comments. In an open letter, 158 philanthropies wrote that organizations should not be attacked for carrying out their missions. The IRS has been misused repeatedly for politically motivated audits from the McCarthy era onwards, says Patrick G. Eddington, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Congress was concerned enough about White House involvement in IRS activities to pass a law in 1998 that explicitly prohibits executive branch influence over taxpayer audits and other investigations. A more recent example of such misuse, Eddington said, was the Obama-era scandal over IRS audits of various Tea Party groups that felt unfairly singled out. The Trump administration settled a lawsuit over those investigations in 2017. Even taking into account the legal difficulties that would be involved, however, the tax exemption threat is concrete in a way some of Trump's other moves against left-leaning groups have not been. September 22, for example, Trump signed an executive order calling for investigatory and prosecutorial action against the loosely affiliated left-wing anti-fascist movement known as Antifa, calling it a domestic terrorist organization, even though the U.S. does not have a domestic terrorism law. Protesters associated with Antifa use imagery and slogans that echo the anti-fascist movements of the 1920s and 1930s in Europe, and the movement has been associated with confrontational protests that sometimes involve violent actions, like setting cars on fire and breaking windows. The precise impact of the Antifa order is murky. The movement lacks leadership or organizational structure, and U.S. law enforcement already have the legal authority to investigate groups that use violence. What is clear is that Trump is showing an increasing willingness to use the power of the federal government to police speech and silence detractors. September 17, ABC temporarily suspended Jimmy Kimmel's late-night show hours after Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brendan Carr complained on a podcast about comments Kimmel had made related to Kirk's shooting. Carr has influence over local stations' broadcast licenses, as well as a merger being sought by the owners of some ABC affiliate stations. We can do this the easy way, Carr said, or the hard way. ABC's suspension of Kimmel seemed to embolden Trump. As he flew back to Washington later that day, he told reporters on Air Force One that if stations give me only bad publicity, press, and they are getting a license, I would think maybe their license should be taken away. Memorial Rally. This is about a half-page photograph. It appears to be in a large stadium or arena type of thing. It is covered. There's a U.S. flag flying from one of the rafters. There's a large, not poster, but fabric photograph of Charlie Kirk Next to the flag, it says, Building a Legacy, Remembering Charlie Kirk. In the very foreground of this photo are five people. Two of them wear shirts with the U.S. flag on the front. And they're holding their, most of them are holding their arms up. One of them has his hands crossed crossed against his chest. But in the background, there are more levels of people, a crowd, but they seem to be in like stadium levels, and they're also mostly raising their hands. Okay, memorial rally, here's the caption. Attendees pray at the memorial service for assassinated conservative activist Charlie Kirk in Glendale, Arizona, September 21. In addition to eulogies, the service included fiery speeches by President Donald Trump and his Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, and the political spectacle of Trump welcoming Elon Musk to his box. Authorities estimated attendance at 90,000. Here's the bulletin. Hefty U.S. fee for foreign worker visas roils the tech industry. This is by Andrew R. Chow and Taryn Pillay. President Donald Trump sent shockwaves through the tech industry September 19 by announcing a $100,000 fee for new employer-filed H-1B visa applications in a move that some worry will harm American innovation, including in the rapidly emerging field of AI, at a time when the U.S. is seeking to outpace foreign rivals. Since 1990, hundreds of thousands of foreigners have moved to the U.S. to work for tech companies through the visa system. But Trump's proclamation said the system had been deliberately exploited to replace, rather than supplement, American workers with lower-paid, lower-skilled labor. The move aims to force tech companies to prioritize American STEM workers. Subodh Kumar, a business professor at Temple University, says it could help the domestic tech job market in the long term, but that a lot of infrastructure will need to be built to make that happen. And that is not an easy task at all, he says. Multiple studies have found the presence of H-1B holders tends to increase job creation and wealth for America writ large. Foreign STEM workers have been an incredible engine of growth, says Giovanni Perry, an economics professor at the University of California, Davis. Top beneficiaries of the H-1B program include Microsoft, Google, and Tesla. Silicon Valley executives who had H-1B visas include Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, as well as Google and Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai. While some experts agree the H-1B system is flawed, they fear the new fee system might push talent and roles overseas and stymie innovation. About 70% of H-1B holders are Indian citizens. Critics of the visa overhaul worry those workers will be priced out of joining U.S. companies and instead return home or flock to other countries with flourishing tech industries, like the UK. Research shows that when large companies cannot hire using H-1Bs, they end up offshoring the work. The new system could also cripple academic and nonprofit organizations that rely on foreign talent to conduct cutting-edge research. The brief news. Good question. Is the U.S. at war with Venezuela? This is by Miranda Chayaratnam. And there's a small photo here. Well, it's almost all blues. The background is ice blue and static. And the middle ground is ripply, icy gray blue. And the foreground is the back of a person wearing a bright light blue shirt. A U.S. destroyer docks in Panama, September 2, during the buildup. The destroyer is in steel gray. It's in the near background, and it's surrounded by three other dark-colored ships. Hours after Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, said the U.S. was trying to provoke a major war, President Donald Trump ordered a strike September 15, targeting a second Venezuelan vessel in international waters, alleging it carried drugs. The strike killed three people. It came less than a month after the U.S. conducted a similar strike on another vessel, killing 11 people, September 2. Trump posted on Truth Social in capital letters, "Be warned, if you are transporting drugs that can kill Americans, we are hunting you." Trump had previously directed U.S. Navy ships to the edge of Venezuelan waters, prompting the Caracas government to mobilize militia forces and bringing the two countries to a precarious standoff. The Trump administration has said its attacks are part of its wider crackdown on drug trafficking into the U.S. On the first day of his second term in office, Trump declared a national emergency over illegal immigration and drug trafficking across the U.S.-Mexico border. The administration has ratcheted up its approach to Venezuela specifically, accusing Maduro of being one of the world's largest drug traffickers and leader of the so-called Cartel of the Suns, which the Venezuelan government has refuted. The administration does not recognize the last two elections Maduro claimed to have won, and in August doubled the reward to $50 million for information leading to the arrest of Maduro, whom Trump has called a dictator. After designated Venezuelan cartel Tren de Aragua as a terrorist organization, Trump accused the group of perpetrating, attempting, and threatening an invasion of predatory incursion against the U.S., invoking the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. He added the gang was conducting irregular warfare at the direction of Maduro. And according to the New York Times, Trump signed a secret directive to the Pentagon last month, authorizing the use of military force against foreign drug cartels. Not long before the September 15 strike, Maduro characterized U.S. actions as aggression all down the line. "It is a police aggression, a political aggression, a diplomatic aggression, and an ongoing aggression of military character." He has also said his country was in maximum readiness to defend itself. Venezuela responded to the September 2 strike by flying two F-16 fighter jets over a U.S. Navy destroyer September 4, to which Trump responded by warning that the U.S. would shoot down Venezuelan jets that put us in a dangerous situation. Observers have raised concerns around the legality of the U.S. strike in international waters and whether the U.S. is headed toward or already engaging in an unauthorized war with Venezuela. The U.N. Charter bars member states from using force unless they're under attack. Michael Becker, an assistant professor of international human rights law at Trinity College, Dublin, told the BBC that declaring the people killed by U.S. strikes are narco-terrorists does not make them lawful military targets and may violate the U.N. Charter and internationally accorded protections of the right to life. It is not just international law in question. U.S. law states Congress has sole constitutional power to declare war, though the president has the authority to use force in limited circumstances under the 2001 and 2002 authorizations of use of military force, AUMF, which have come under bipartisan criticism for giving presidents a blank check to bypass Congress in ordering military actions. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly told the New York Times September 15 that Trump's order for the first strike was in line with the laws of armed conflict to protect our country from those trying to bring poison to our shores. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have questioned the strikes, including Senators Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, and Adam Schiff, Democrat California, who said September 15 he plans to introduce a war powers resolution to reclaim Congress's power to declare war. In video posted on X, he said, "I do not want to see us get into some war with Venezuela, because the president is just blowing ships willy-nilly out of the water." Here's the milestones page. Recognized a state of Palestine, land of their own, by Richard Hall. 10 Western countries, including the UK, France, Canada, Australia, and Portugal, formally recognized a Palestinian state in the run-up to the September 23 start of the UN General Assembly. The move was framed as both a rebuke of Israel's continued assault in Gaza and an attempt to salvage hopes for Palestinian self-determination. Since 1988, nearly 150 other nations have recognized Palestinian statehood during a period when diplomacy played a key role in the conflict. UK leader Keir Starmer said the decision to join them was made to keep alive the possibility of peace and a two-state solution. The largely symbolic action also isolates the Trump administration, which has backed Israel's opposition to Palestinian statehood. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the decision a prize for Hamas. "It will not happen," he added. "A Palestinian state will not be established west of the Jordan River." In a September 16 report, the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry determined Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Israel strongly rejected the finding and called for the commission to be abolished. The center article, died Robert Redford, actor, director, and activist extraordinaire. Stephanie Zakarik writes this column, and there is a photo, about a third of a page in size, in black and white. It's a portrait of Robert Redford. This is in his younger years, where he has that nice head of hair. It looks blondish brown in this photo. His eyes are of an indeterminate color. He's smiling slightly at the camera. His eyes are looking at the camera. His right cheek is leaning against his right hand. He's wearing a button-down shirt and a striped tie, again of indeterminate coloration. A movie star who used his charm, influence, and money to give aspiring filmmakers a start in the movie business to help protect the natural world from those who would strip it for their own gain, to show by example how film storytelling can not only reflect facets of the American character but also help shape it. A human being who could do all that seems almost impossible to fathom in this age of disinformation, misinformation, and discord. But that was Robert Redford, who died September 16 at age 89. He was an actor, director, and producer who chose his projects carefully. His directorial debut, 1980s Ordinary People, won 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. As a performer, he gravitated toward roles that exposed the absurdity of American politics and its potential to foster corruption. Chief among them, All the President's Men, 1976, in which he played reporter Bob Woodward, who, with Carl Bernstein, broke the Watergate scandal. Redford's career was shaped around the idea that the best qualities of the American spirit could prevail against corruption and deceit. He was a tireless advocate for environmental causes, and in 1981 he founded the Sundance Institute to help independent filmmakers bring their work to a wider audience, later expanding that reach with the Sundance Film Festival. But most essentially, he was a communicator, an artist who could speak to us in a place beyond words with just the flicker of a smile. And in the final right-hand column, there are five additional short items. Removed: the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, as patron or ambassador from several charities after a 2011 email showed she had described convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein as her supreme friend. And here's a little inset photo of the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson. She's wearing a bright turquoise dress with a metal belt. It is collarless, and we see her very long, very bright and dark red hair. She's grinning at something, and the camera has captured that, and she's wearing a headpiece that looks like it's in black, although it could be in dark navy. Moving through this column, pardoned: pro-democracy Egyptian-British activist Alaa Abda El Fattah, known for his participation in the 2011 Arab Spring Uprising, September 22. Abda El Fattah had been incarcerated for nearly 12 years. Sentenced former French President Nicolas Sarkozy to 5 years in prison after being found guilty of criminal conspiracy in a case tied to alleged illegal campaign funding by the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Dismissed: President Trump's $15 billion defamation lawsuit against the New York Times by a Florida federal judge September 19. Trump was given 28 days to file a new complaint. Arrested: 11 elected New York Democratic officials September 18 after trying to gain access to cells used by immigration enforcement officials to detain migrants. Goodbye to the Robert Redford page, and on to the brief health. Five Ways to Ease Your Nighttime Anxiety by Angela Haupt. Sweet dreams are more like a pipe dream when 12 a.m. turns into 2 a.m. and you still cannot stop worrying about all the work you have to do, the bills you need to pay, the argument you had with your sister, and the feeling that you maybe, probably, definitely are going to die sooner than you should because of a lack of sleep. Experts say almost everyone experiences this kind of middle-of-the-night panic at some point. The most basic and common reason why we get more anxious at night is because of the decrease in the amount of distraction and activity we have going on, says Michael G. Wetter, a clinical psychologist and director of psychology in the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine at UCLA Medical Center. Our mind goes off the road, and there's nothing to guide us and keep us on track and focused and feeling productive. So what should you do about your racing thoughts at night? Thrash around till the sun comes up? Open your laptop and start chipping away at your to-do list? or find some way to put those unwanted thoughts to bed. The last approach is most promising, but the steps to take are not necessarily what you think. Simply clearing your mind, for instance, is not always the right approach, since a busy brain can keep anxiety at bay. We asked Wetter and other experts to share their favorite ways to soothe nighttime anxiety. Carve out worry time. Before bed, spend 5 minutes making two lists. On one, write down everything you're worried about and that is within your control. And on the other, log the things you cannot do anything about. The first will serve as a to-do list for the next day. You are telling your brain, hey, I heard you, and I do not want these things to be unfinished either, says Leah Kaler, a clinical psychologist and sleep expert. Then, rip up the second list. Once you write your unresolvable worries down, they'll leave you alone, because your brain will be content that the situation has at least been acknowledged. Tap into your five senses. Keep something textured by your bed, like a smooth stone, that you can touch as soon as you get anxious. Sip on cool water, listen to soft ambient music, or find other ways to ground yourself via your five senses. For many people, including myself, the sensation of cool bed sheets signals, okay, this is the time, or I can just melt into this, Wetter says. Sometimes we dismiss the power of our own sensitivity. Anchoring yourself in the present moment can pull your mind away from spiraling thoughts, helping you feel at ease. Get out of bed. Staying under the covers can reinforce the association between bed and stress. If you know you're not going to fall asleep in the next 15 to 20 minutes, you should get up, Kaler says. Ideally, you will relocate to a dim room, since bright lights signal to the brain it's time to wake up. Then do something very boring, she advises, like an adult coloring book or folding laundry. Once you feel sleepy, get back in bed. With time, you will train yourself that the bedroom is for sleeping only, not a place where anxiety rears its ugly head. Keep a comfort script nearby. If you are prone to jolting awake in panic, Wetter suggests keeping a calming message or affirmation affixed to your nightstand. It is another grounding technique that he has found helps people self-soothe quickly. Your note might say something like, you will deal with it tomorrow. It is not as big a deal as you were making it out to be, or everything is going to be okay. These mantras trigger that sense of reasonability, rationality, and calm, Wetter says. Reframe how you think about waking up. When you've been tossing and turning for hours, you'll probably become even more anxious over the idea that your exhaustion is going to ruin the next day. Reframe that catastrophic thinking, Wetter urges. The less pressure you put on getting enough rest, the easier it becomes to fall back asleep. Tell yourself, I'm going to enjoy the moment of calm, Wetter says. I'm just going to let my body relax. Business. Shifting winds. How major banks like J.P. Morgan are rethinking their climate strategies. By Justin Warland, Scottsdale, Arizona. This spring, as global markets gyrated, some of the world's most influential investors and executives sat in a Scottsdale, Arizona conference room, engaged in deep discussion. But rather than President Donald Trump's tariffs, the 120 attendees were focused on the future of energy, climate, and sustainability. Across the conference ballroom were individuals representing a combined $4.3 trillion in market capitalization and $4.2 trillion in assets under management. At my table sat J.P. Morgan Chase & Company CEO Jamie Dimon, Microsoft founder turned philanthropist Bill Gates, and Jim Farley, the CEO of the Ford Motor Company. Elsewhere in the room, I spotted an oil and gas CEO, a prominent clean tech innovator, and some of the world's biggest asset managers. For all the financial might, there was hardly any hype or grandeur. There was little indication of the host or the purpose of the gathering convened at the Four Seasons Resort. A logo on the wall simply read, Scottsdale Action Forum, but at the center of the room, Dimon, the conference host, sat, watching intently. To many casual climate observers, it may look as if the world's biggest companies in the financial sector and beyond are shunning climate work because the political zeitgeist has made it inconvenient. But the truth is far more complicated. Global markets and regulatory pressures keep the issue on the corporate radar. And out of the public eye, executives continue to search for a path forward. It's just unlikely they will settle on the path everyone envisioned 5 years ago. We have an issue. We should face it. Dimon told the crowd about the world's growing carbon emissions. But at the same time, he said, the U.S. needs a more rational conversation than how the climate dialogue is often framed. We have to have a full, honest assessment. For J.P. Morgan, that has meant affirming its commitment to financing oil and gas and acknowledging that it may not meet the bold climate targets it set in 2021, if the broader economic and policy landscape does not change. At the same time, the firm has not given up on efforts to build a green banking business or the push to drive global emissions reductions. In fact, the company's corporate clients continue to demand they do so, no matter the political winds. There is a huge market for clean energy that is profitable. It is not a giveaway, Dimon told me when we spoke again in July. In his telling, rational energy solutions cannot mean banks make loans that are going to go bad or stop financing people who provide safe, reliable, affordable energy. J.P. Morgan is far from the only financial institution trying to thread this needle. For much of the past decade, the industry has occupied a central role in efforts to tackle climate change. In what I've taken to calling the Wall Street fix, climate advocates have sought to make banks, insurers, and other financial institutions central players in efforts to cut emissions. In the simplest terms, the theory goes, the financial sector can bring about the energy transition by financing good things, that is, clean energy, and cutting funding for fossil fuels. During the pandemic, banks announced targets to show their commitment to climate. But politics and markets have been rocked by events ranging from the Russian invasion of Ukraine to the U.S. presidential election. This dynamic means the financial sector is caught fighting two distinct battles on the same front. Conservatives say banks have gone woke, unfairly favoring renewable energy, and have threatened firms with lawsuits and investigations. At the same time, some climate groups argue J.P. Morgan, with its substantial funding of oil and gas, has failed to do its part. Indeed, climate scenarios show clearly the world needs to shift away from fossil fuels to meet climate goals. Many with less fixed views have come to think the most influential companies have simply given up. If the crowd in Scottsdale is any indicator, the private sector remains engaged. Many of the most influential corporate and financial players have modulated their public messaging and adjusted their climate-friendly work, but they are very far from abandoning it. The conversation in April centered not on the need to advance clean technologies, that's taken as a given, but rather on how to do so profitably in line with client and investor expectations. How much money is invested at below market return for green purposes, like none, zero, said Diamond. Indeed, getting capital to flow will require a society-wide shift. And while they may not have all the answers, one clear conclusion was reached in Scottsdale. Profit will be the easiest way to make the Wall Street fix real. At a conference table on the 41st floor of J.P. Morgan's headquarters in Manhattan, Doug Petno is flexing his fluency across the languages of climate, finance, and old-school oil and gas. He speaks about addressing climate change as existential, but also hails natural gas as one of the biggest decarbonizing forces for the U.S. because of its role in replacing dirtier coal. He mentions leveraged buyouts and nature protection in the same breath. Petno, a rumored potential successor to Diamond and co-CEO of J.P. Morgan's commercial and investment bank, began his career at the firm 35 years ago, structuring deals in the natural resources division. But by the early 2010s, the firm began to get pushback from both activists and clients for financing the polluting sector. So Petno, with the support of the company's other senior executives, began exploring how to advance the company's sustainability strategy, not for the marketing or government relations divisions, but for the company's core business. We wanted to build our franchise in a sustainable way that would be climate smart, carbon smart, apolitical, science-based, but fundamentally do what we do best as a bank, Petno says, to respond to banker and customer questions about climate change and evolving energy markets. Petno set up a brain trust of sorts with a new hub dubbed the Center for Carbon Transition. Senior bankers were pulled in from across the firm and tasked with studying climate change and the energy transition. The center became home for climate scientists, dozens of whom are now employed across J.P. Morgan. And then there's the firm's green economy banking practice, designed to service clients in clean technology with subject matter expertise. Petno says that at the time of its launch, the bank knew the sector would be cyclical, feast or famine, to use his words. But investments were nonetheless meant to be as profit-oriented as they were climate-oriented. Last year, J.P. Morgan generated more than $1 billion in revenue from green transactions and clients. But activist pressure has remained consistent. Following the adoption of the Paris Agreement in 2015, the Rainforest Action Network activist group rated the bank as the world's biggest financier of fossil fuels, a title that the bank retained as of last year. In 2018, in one big demonstration, protesters chained themselves to a sculpture in one of the company's New York offices over its financing of oil pipelines. Climate activist Bill McKibben once called Diamond an oil, coal, and gas baron almost without peer. Indeed, even with the bank's growing climate investments, a fundamental mismatch remained. What is rational to a bank is not necessarily rational for the planet. and humanity. The planet needs us to cut emissions. Banks need to continue making a profit. In the first years of the COVID-19 pandemic, the activist pressure and profit motive seemed to be aligning. Combined with low interest rates, investor demands, and policy pushes, companies and financial firms made a series of bold climate pledges. In 2021, the banks showed up at the UN Climate Conference in Glasgow with a series of splashy commitments. Those included a goal to align J.P. Morgan's funding in key sectors with a pathway to a world of net zero carbon emissions and a goal of financing $1 trillion in green initiatives by 2030. At the time, the firm joined with its counterparts in coalitions like the Net Zero Banking Alliance, NZBA, and Climate Action 100+. Even still, to activists' dismay, at no point did J.P. Morgan say it would stop financing fossil fuels. In his 2020 annual letter, Diamond had said J.P. Morgan would continue to work with oil and gas firms and argued that abandoning companies that produce and consume these fuels is not a solution. Diamond's approach proved prescient. In 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine and energy prices soared. The Biden administration went from talking about the decline of oil and gas to pushing companies to produce more. Around the same time, political backlash to parts of the EU's Green Deal led to the bloc softening green policies. Supply chain crunches slowed key technologies, and then there was Trump's return to power. J.P. Morgan tries to exude an aggressively nonpartisan and apolitical attitude. When I talked to Diamond just after the passage of Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which gutted most Biden-era clean energy programs, he declined to endorse or reject the measure, saying it contained some good things and some bad things. To be clear, every analysis of the law's climate impact shows U.S. emissions will be higher than they would have been without its passage. Many casual observers conclude the private sector, banks, and big companies alike has given up. But is it true? What is clear is that J.P. Morgan and the sector more broadly have fallen behind their targets. Between its 2021 pledge and now, the firm has financed $240 billion in climate initiatives. That is not a small sum, but still does not put it on track to meet its $1 trillion goal, the deadline for which is just 5 years away. Petno acknowledged the company might not meet its target. It is going to depend a little on how open and receptive the capital markets are, he told me. It is much the same across the sector. Many of the biggest banks have moved away from rigid portfolio-wide pledges toward looser guardrails and deal-by-deal discretion. The collapse of the industry coalitions, like the NZBA, has garnered significant press attention. One by one, banks, including J.P. Morgan, have left the group. In August, it announced it was pausing operations. But to say the sector has lost interest, or worse, would be to miss the forest for the trees. Debt issued to support sustainable investments continues to increase. Transition finance, where financial firms actively pursue opportunities to fund polluting companies' emissions reductions, has become a hot area. And most importantly, clients are still asking questions about climate. Diamond, for one, argues that what looks like walking away is really just a refocusing. The things people are dropping, he says, is stuff that just did not work and was virtue signaling. In a sign of its continued commitment Last year, the firm hired Sarah Kapnick, a former chief scientist at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to serve as the firm's global head of climate advisory. She put it succinctly, "My job would not exist. None of this would exist if there wasn't clear client demand for it." As the gathering in Scottsdale wore on, attendees bounced between discussions on everything from electrification to policy to trade. At a candlelit dinner, they listened to speakers wax on geopolitics. The goal, Petno says, is to create a crucible for combustion to happen. Given this was an event hosted by the world's largest bank, one might expect the most consequential conversations to have centered on capital, and there certainly was discussion of that. Nonetheless, the conclusion of many conversations seemed only tangentially related to finance. Stable policy, durable business models, public-private collaboration will go just as far. Investors, industry participants, developers, banks, they need good rules, says Petno. When the rules swing with every election year or some other priority, it is hard to get on solid footing. In some ways, that is J.P. Morgan's climate story, too, and the story of finance more broadly. The world needs more financial innovation to tackle climate change, but the sector operates in a much broader societal context. Finance is a poor bulwark when policies and markets constantly shift. At the end of the day, you have one CEO on the other side of the table that's making the decision. And you cannot simply say, "Hey, invest more in climate," says Rama Varyankaval, who oversees the Center for Carbon Transition. He'll walk out the door. Instead, Varyankaval says you need to make the case in terms of how it impacts the balance sheet, credit ratings, or shareholder engagement. Only if you are able to give them a complete picture and say, "Here are all the domino effects of doing that," only then is it useful. In this issue, Time has included 100 next people. That's another list. So I'll read a few. Susan Bowman, Microbe Sleuth, by Matthew Meyerson. Susan Bowman, a scientist at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, studies how the digestive tract's microbiome can affect the development of oral and colorectal cancers. Advances in DNA sequencing now allow scientists to see a fuller picture of the microbes found in the body and to identify variations that affect health. Susan, who was a research fellow in my laboratory at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, has elucidated the connection between the microbiome and the immune response. Her groundbreaking research offers new potential avenues for screening and treatments for cancers that are on the rise. The work that scientists like Susan are doing on the cancer microbiome could also help untangle a new mystery in colorectal cancer. Why are so many more young people now getting this terrible disease? Meyerson, the author, is professor at Harvard Medical School and researcher at Dana-Farber. Ray Allensworth, Lunar Lander, by Jeffrey Kluger. It says something about Firefly Aerospace of Cedar Park, Texas, that at 32, Ray Allensworth counts as the grand dame of mission control. The average age is just 28. At March 2, that team of shiny young minds, led by Allensworth, the company's spacecraft program director, made history, becoming the first private firm to successfully land a spacecraft on the moon. Blue Ghost, the 6.6-foot-tall ship, was carrying scientific instruments as part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, CLPS, program, which enlists the private sector to deliver cargo to the moon for future lunar base. Other companies are involved, but Allensworth is determined to keep the lead. We landed Mission 1. We're building Mission 2. We're in design of Mission 3, and we were just awarded Mission 4, she says. If you have the right experience and perspective, even at a young age, you are able to do something really important. Bob Mumgarde and Brandon Sorbonne, Catalyzing Fusion by Bill Gates, who's chair of the Gates Foundation and an investor in CFS. Imagine a future where the world is powered by fusion. Access to virtually limitless clean energy could unlock a new era of prosperity and improve human welfare dramatically. When that day arrives, it will be a reflection of the early leadership and bold vision of pioneers like Commonwealth Fusion Systems CEO Bob Mumgarde and Chief Scientific Officer Brandon Sorbonne and their entire team. Bob and Brandon are proving that with the right combination of scientific rigor and commercial instincts, fusion can become a game-changing reality. That last little item was slightly abridged because we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.